Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Matt Cantor. Matt is a home analyst. He looks through the architectural rules, and he's a home inspector. He's also a columnist for the Berkeley Daily Planet, a writer on a lot of topics. And I actually met Matt 5 years ago or so when my home was inspected by him. And we not only got a lot out of, I learned a lot about homes and what was going wrong, but we carried on in a very interesting conversation for 5 or 6 hours as we were doing it. And I've met him several times since then, and I knew he would be great for this program. So that's where Matt comes from. And without any further ado, we're going to get started. The only thing is that the format, as I said last time, you know, it's variable. It'll depend upon what's going on, how much the audience wants to jump in. But I will carry on a dialogue with Matt after he makes his presentation to elicit certain ideas, and then we'll open it up to everybody. So we'll have at least a half an hour for everybody just to talk about the ideas. So, Matt Cantor.
I'm not as tall as George is, so I'm going to move this down a little bit. Before I even get into, I have a prepared set of materials because it's going to make it easier for me to make my points. Before I do that, I just want to say I'm not an ethicist. I'm not a rhetorician. I'm an individual. That's my qualifications are no greater than anybody in the room and probably less than some. We probably have some ethicists and rhetoricians and philosophers, and I hope I get a chance to hear from them. But this is basically one person's point of view about an issue that I am personally passionate about. Hopefully I will be a little bit more dialectical about my approach and less a person who speaks just from passion. And I'm very excited to hear what people will have to say. So as I, you know, as I present what I have to say, I hope you will pick out things that you disagree with, you agree with, you think are important, and let's talk about them afterwards. I think this is an incredibly important issue. And in fact, though we are talking about evil itself, it will become quickly apparent that this echoes into larger quarters and essentially how we use language to talk about ethical issues. So, does evil exist? I'd like to start by sharing that I consider myself to be an atheist, and that I consider this in no small way to be extremely relevant to the discussion. Let me apologize at the outset to those of you who believe in a God. I will speak frankly on this subject, and my point of view may seem callous, though it is not my intent. I simply cannot allow in any area of discourse, as crucial as this one, any quarter for consideration of what I believe to be mendacious or inaccurate. By the way, this is a semantical issue, and there are those who may wish to say that evil is nothing more than a word for what is undesirable, but it is clear that this is not the case by context. We do not use the word evil to describe an auto accident or the knife that impales a victim, though we may choose to use it for the person who did it. We understand that these things are without harmful intent, and that is at the core of this discussion. Evil, in the character we invoke when we use it today, is certainly primitive, though it plays chords that are present throughout the Judeo-Christian and Muslim worlds over the last several thousand years, though Islam and Christianity have shorter lives than Judaism. It is precisely this primitive quality that I wish to attend most closely to, because it is this quality that makes it most dangerous, and I do not want to underplay this nature. I consider the use of the word evil and the notion to be very dangerous and at least profoundly regressive. Here's the problem. When we use the word evil, we throw a cognitive blanket over the subject that carries with it the message that not only is this thing extremely dangerous and untrustworthy, It is also made so by forces that cannot be scientifically investigated or rectified without divine intervention. A thing that is evil is not simply an undesirable thing. We have plenty of words for that. Something may be heinous without being made so by God or by other supernatural forces. Something may be grievous, literally causing us to grieve, and have nothing more than mechanical causes. We may consider something very dangerous, such as developing cancer or drinking poison, without bringing any divine element into the picture. And we can call this woeful, hateful, or dreadful, and never bring evil into the arena. Nonetheless, some people will choose to refer to a case of melanoma as being evil. And there is no doubt that this was a common conclusion before the age of science. For a person born before the awakening of reason and of scientific thinking, and sadly, for many born after this era, can you think of any? There was not enough understanding of natural events, biology, physics, chemistry, and the like, to escape the plausibility of inexplicable events being sponsored by the action of unseen personalities. So it was reasonable science, say 10,000 years ago, to look at natural events as the result of divine intervention. That's the best they had. They didn't know what made thunder come down, so they came up with a person to do it. That was reasonable science at that time. They were looking for an answer. Also, like children, we would assume that bad things happened to us because we were bad. We still do that, and child psychology has benefited enormously from this realization. Or merely living in an actively hostile and untrustworthy world. If we don't have adequate science to provide more reasonable answers. Again, some will say that the point is merely semantic, and that evil is a perfectly valid way of describing something horrible or something caused by a person or people who are so misguided that there is no more accurate way to describe the condition. This is clearly an enormous mistake, and for primarily one formidable reason, that being that when we call something evil, we arrest the reasoning process. Whether we realize it or not in the moment, we have drawn a viable or practical conclusion before any scientific analysis or more intricate study of the cause of the event can be made. We have our answer. It's because of evil. We've concluded that something unseen and with malicious intent has overridden any natural mechanisms to create a grievous condition. Not merely a new set of neutral circumstances, but something created with harm and grief in mind. Evil connotes intent, not merely undesirability. This is why it is so harmful and misdirective. Now, every set of circumstances looks different from different perspectives. This is a toughie. And give it a chance. 3,000 people dead in a pair of collapsed buildings can look like the end of the world if someone close to you or many friends were killed, but this event could be viewed in a very different way. Let's say that Adolf Hitler and the top members of the Third Reich were in a pair of similar buildings, planning their next moves when a brave group of soldiers managed to hijack several German planes and fly them into these buildings, destroying 3,000 members of the German army, including hundreds of clerical workers and minor functionaries. These soldiers would have statues erected in their honor in every major city in the United States, and there would be no end of movies, books, and TV miniseries lauding this heroic and historic act. Now, one can say that the people who destroyed the Twin Towers did so because they are misguided and hateful people, but it's really all a matter of perspective. I'm a pacifist myself, and the act of killing anyone for any purpose seems to me to be unjustifiable, regardless of nearly any circumstances. I struggle with this one myself. What might those circumstances be? How do you determine the value of one or many human lives? It's impossible. We are not equipped to perform such calculus, and therefore I conclude that we should not attempt to do so. Life is precious, period. Nonetheless, I understand that some people see killing as an end to a means, but that when you are on the receiving end of this epistemology, it generally appears to be unreasonable. And the winners write the history books. We tend to view criminals as evil much of the time, and this is a crime in and of itself. Crimes vary widely, and yet many persons guilty of nonviolent crimes are subjected to the horrors of penal life. For the occupants of many of these facilities, rape, beatings, or the simple deprivation of basic human dignity is a daily reality. Some were guilty of selling drugs or using drugs. Some were guilty of petty theft. Nonetheless, since we are able to view criminality as evil, and I believe we do without realizing it, carrying an intent beyond the misguided behavior, we do not extend the sort of care to these individuals that we would extend to non-criminal citizens. Not only does this produce poor results, it is immoral and based on faulty logic. We end up with angry and less productive people emerging from this system, and often those who have learned criminal attitudes and skills. If we look at criminal activity on a more dispassionate, case-specific basis, we would be far less likely to detain any given individual, but might choose a wide range of alternatives, including training for jobs and a range of other social services. There is no doubt that our ability to alter the behavior of some dangerous individuals is currently very limited, and these people need to be incarcerated until neurology or other relevant sciences provide us with suitable solutions. I am not suggesting that we throw the baby out with the bathwater and say that everybody's good and that everybody should roam free. If we need to do this with some, then it's our duty to do so in the least harmful manner. I'll spare the pulpit further on this issue, but my point is that we Americans allow the continued incarceration and dehumanization of 1% of our population. That's the highest figure in the world. Higher than Burundi, higher than China, it's really pretty shocking, and it's well worth looking into. Because we look at criminality through a religious lens, that's my position, that we look at it through a religious lens, through the lens of good and evil. I am very clear that we as a society do not see it this way, but our language belies our supposed neutrality. We refer to criminality as a social evil, and its purveyors, at least the more dangerous ones, as evildoers. We cast an ethical stain over those who commit most crimes beyond the most mundane and consider these as lost souls who must redeem themselves. Religious language paints itself over much of what we do in our judicial and penal systems. Punishment may be the popular choice for the Christian saint, but there is very little evidence that it makes a person more suitable for society. The horrific shaming and terrorization of imprisonment is not really designed to make people better members of society, but is intended instead to make us feel better when we are the victims. And it's also about class suppression, I would argue. Any good manager knows that carrots work better than sticks, and this simple logic isn't used in our penal system because it's not what we deeply intend. We're not really interested in making people better. Warfare is the same. Addressing the differences that differing sides in a dispute possess is always best handled with dialogue. Killing is obviously the admission of a failure in this process, and while one can always say that the other side refused to compromise, the cost of war is so great, so horrible, that any sane individual will clearly stay at the table until the bitter dregs have been drunk, and longer. Again, as with the penal system, when we resort to referring to our subject as an evildoer or part of an axis of evil, those are the words of our last president, those of you who haven't heard that, it casts this blanket of cognitive deadening over our opponent. Being evil, there is no point in attempting to address their concerns or preferences. There is no point in attempting to diagnose their reasoning, suffering, or choices. They have been reduced to the status of demon or homunculus. It is a lazy logic and a cheap trick that dehumanizes us more than our opponent, and more importantly, decreases our ability to reach a sane and morally conscionable result. Again, I do not mean to say that we should turn ourselves over to killers or hostile opponents. I merely suggest that we start with our language, recognizing the enormous power it wields in establishing a fair tableau of analysis at the commencement of evaluating any hostile or dangerous situation. If we are looking at a criminal, look at the whole man or woman and what we wish to achieve at the end of our intervention. If we are looking at a foreign country and its military, what are our differences and our objectives? How can we use language to see the other as a potential partner, or at least a moral equal in a competition? In this way, we might be less well-armed to do our opponent harm, I'm not sure, but may not find ourselves at the brink. The fact that we, the people of the world, are in possession of around 20,000 nuclear weapons, the U.S. has roughly half of this, is, I would posit, the result of a demonization of our opponents and not merely a function of practicality. There is virtually no condition that we can imagine living in that would be worse than the one that would come to pass if even a tiny fraction of these devices were deployed. Living on a farm with minimal technology and goods might be difficult, but it would still include sunny days, beautiful people, love, and friendship. If we did not view some of our neighbor countries as evil and cast over them the discoloration of malice and its attendant dehumanization, I do not believe that we would tolerate the existence of these unconscionable horrors of technology. Words are very powerful tools, and evil is one that has done great harm and should be relegated to the museum where such things are studied under glass. We are beyond this now, as we are beyond stone axes. Since nothing less than the future of humanity is at stake, let us choose words with care as befits their power and import. Thank you very much.
I want to take this in a couple of different directions, and I'd like to get back to the main topic. But before I do that,
hello.
Yeah. But before I do that, I'd like to talk about you focused on prison for a little while.
Yeah.
you said that obviously prison is very popular. And even the death penalty is very popular in the United States.
Yeah.
And if you look back at history and you say the Wild West period of time, people did not get incarcerated for even murder as long as it was within a certain defined amount, because otherwise you'd have to put away half the population in prison. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't do it. So I think that who we put in prison depends upon what you can afford and what the average personality in the society is. Looking at that, I mean, I can see your point, but evil, the question...
It's also a business.
It's also a business, yes. I don't know, if I just read this on the way here that Schwarzenegger has proposed that we have a prison in Mexico because we'll save money.
Oh, my God.
For Mexican illegal immigrants. I thought then that you put them in prison down there, but they're already in Mexico. So you might as well just open the doors and let them go. I don't quite understand what the finances of that are or the policy of it is. But in any case, that's about the prison idea a little bit. But what I'd like to go back to is the basic concept. I think a lot of people are aware that this is a loaded term, that it has roots that are very deep, and that it causes but it's also an energizing word, and that's why it's being used. It's used because it energizes people to action, whereas if you have a nice rational analysis of something, most people are not energized to action.
Well, it energizes them to action through fear,
right,
which has been a very popular energizing mechanism. I would argue that our last administration used it a great deal. They used fear a great deal. So there's all kinds of fear-hot words that were used.
Right. Okay, so let's go back to the basic concept. Now, If you talk about evil, one of the things I noticed in your speech was you talked about people who were good as being automatically all right in a sense. You accepted, if you can put it, that certain you, You said that we put people into a category of evil and then we dehumanize them. Now, if we accept a certain sort of behavior as good by definition, we kind of do the same thing.
Agreed. Absolutely.
In theory. Okay. So let's look at good and evil from a different point of view. Obviously, we have the historical context, which you gave us, of why it's so popular to look at it as evil and maybe what the inadequate way of trying to come to a conclusion. Now we've had a lot more time to think about it. But if you look at good and evil, is there any objective measurement behind the emotional attachments, in your opinion?
I don't think so. I don't think you can do it that way. I think everything is contextual. Now, I do think that there are, within context, there are behaviors that we consider, that we should consider to be acceptable and unacceptable. And I think we should devote a tremendous amount of energy to that. But it's always contextual. And to step out, you know, to sort of a, you know, in a wider frame, if I take a gun and I shoot her, mm-hmm. and I'm convinced...
No, wait a minute. She's part of our audience.
Okay. And I'm convinced, and I have proof that she's a terrible person, mm-hmm. I will still go to jail, or somebody's going to come and shoot me.
Right.
But send me into a wartime situation and take someone who I know nothing about, who's on the other side, let me shoot them, and I'm a hero.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think that's pretty well accepted as a relative problem of war and training people for war. So I'd like to get back to the basic concept about using this word and propose an idea that there is an objective basis to this concept, but that it's a little bit different than people assume.
Okay.
If you take the analogy of hot and cold,
okay.
Hot and cold are relative concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But there's an objective basis, which is the internal motion of an object. You take an object, how much internal motion is there? Now, this is room temperature. We are slightly higher than room temperature. So this feels a little bit cool to us.
Mm-hmm.
Not cold, but a little bit cool, because we're 98.6 degrees. And if it's something that's 120 degrees, we feel it's a little bit warm, even a little bit hot. 200 degrees, it's getting too hot. So that's really hot. Now, if it's something is minus zero, you know, if you grew up in Wisconsin like I did, you used to experience this all the time, you know what cold really is.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's an objective basis, but it's very relative. There's an internal motion of the object.
I would argue that you just argued against yourself right there.
Why?
Because I think that if you asked a scientist to tell you what's hot or cold, they would say, well, there is no hot or cold. You have to give me the specifics about it. And I would say that evil only works as a word, relative to something else, but that because of what we do with that word, it is so deadening to the cognitive process and is so morally unfair that it really doesn't belong in the language. It's just too dangerous, and it's too regressive for us to attempt to work with in any way.
Okay. Well, I agree with you on that.
I think it's overly simplifying, and it's really dangerous.
Well, but let's go back to the idea that people oversimplify, and we're dealing with humanity. So if we talk about the hot and cold, if we go back to the analogy, we're talking about two relative concepts. And an objective basis, the scientists would say there's a certain amount of action within an object that starts at, you know, absolute zero and moves up. And that nothing is hot or cold. Everything is a certain amount of internal motion in an object. Now, our relative perception of hot and cold depends upon where we stand and what our internal motion is. Okay? So now let's look at good and evil the same way. That is, that people define good and evil, people look at good and evil as something that is relative to their own personality. I'll give you an example. I think I gave this last month, too, for a different reason. If you look at human personality as spread out on a curve, I don't have a thing, I'll just end up. If human personality is spread out on a bell curve, right? And at one end you have, at the low end you have psychopaths, people who don't have any feeling for other people at all, and that's that one. Take the other end and you say maybe the most rational scientific people who don't have all those emotions about all those things, and the leaders of thought and so on, and they're out at this end. And then the mass of humanity is you know, got a personality that's sort of in the middle. Now what's interesting to me in analyzing this problem many years ago is that
If you ask a person as a psychopath what they think of humanity, they think that everybody is too good, they're foolish, they're too good to get along in this dog-eat-dog world, because their perception is it's a dog-eat-dog world. And they're here, and they're looking at all of humanity being, in a way, more generous-hearted than they are. Now, you ask the person who's right smack in the middle of this bell curve with personality in the middle, and you ask them, what do they think of humanity? And they say, generally good, people are pretty decent, I like my neighbors, I like just generally life, and no, people aren't too dangerous. We have a few psychopaths over on this one end, you know, but in general, things are just fine. Now, the interesting thing is when you talk to the people at this end, they all say, needs reforming, total reform, they really are pathetic. There's no way, I don't know how they even can live, I don't know how they can even survive with each other, because they're over here looking back at this perspective. So now, if we just take the overall sort of objective spread of human personality, what's interesting to me when I was analyzing different philosophies, looking for ideas that were useful, was that almost everybody who's made a contribution has been way over at this end, thinking that everybody needs serious reformation. But the bulk of humanity is not there. The bulk of humanity is right here. And if you weren't, I mean, if you just think about it for a second, if you're a reformer, clearly you already are disagreeing with the vast majority. It's sort of like Mark Twain's statement, that if you ever find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to reform. that kind of sums it up. And what I would say the objective thing here is that good and evil are how people look at, relative to themselves, on this objective scale, how people live their lives relative to each other. So that the evil is the evil concept. I'm not saying that we should use the concepts. I'm just saying that that concept serves a very functional purpose for everybody, because it does deaden the humanity of the people that are characterized that way, and therefore allows them to act against this. The psychopaths don't have this problem. They don't have to say evil. They just say human, and they're fine.
Playing devil's advocate.
Yeah.
Appropriately enough. I disagree, and the reason that I disagree is that, you know, hot and cold are relative to one another. I don't think that when we use, I think good can be used as the opposite of evil, but I think it's a different kind of a, I think it is functionally a very different kind of a problem, because I think that what we should be looking at is the difference between good and evil as one thing versus a scientific analysis at the other end. Mm-hmm. A deeper looking, instead of accepting a behavior as simply being positive or negative, we should be looking at what is the root cause? What made somebody do that? Were they neurologically impaired? Do they have a brain injury? You know, a lot of people who are murderers turn out to have been head beaten and have physical trauma. So what I'm arguing for is, for any particular kind of behavior, looking layers behind, looking scientifically at what that is, and then giving due through that process to whatever the perspective is. Because we don't have a good, if we don't do that, then all we're doing is looking at our preferences versus somebody else's preferences.
Even when you're doing that, you still have an idea in your mind about what the goal of society is, how it should be organized, and you are saying which behaviors are good and evil, or which ones should be modified or not modified based upon what you think should happen in society.
Well, I do absolutely. I think that's a great point, and I do think this needs to be done on a democratic basis. I don't think that, I posit this as a starting point for us to democratically agree, and I don't mean we Americans or the people in this room, but everybody in the world, engage in a discussion to determine how we will evaluate what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior, and attempt to get behind religious notions, and I would argue that evil is a religious notion, mm-hmm. and say, how do we determine what are acceptable and unacceptable behaviors, and then where we look at, you know, and this enables us to take a closer look at things that we generally disagree with, and look at those individuals, the individuals who are, say, killers, take a closer look at why are they that way? Why do Muslim jihadists choose to do what they do. Let's take a closer look at what their philosophies are, because when we do that, we yield answers and we make the world a better place. And we know that about all kinds of things. And I would argue that the reason that we are able to live as multiple nations in relative harmony, I mean, there are wars in the world, but we live in relative harmony, we travel across country borders, we learn each other's languages, that is because we've put aside already a lot of notions, false notions that we had about Black people, Chinese people, and strangers in general. We've become less xenophobic by learning about what they are, and when we become more scientific, when we understand something in greater detail, we can say, okay, well, this specific behavior we're going to isolate. But the rest of it, that we'll simply understand, well, that's different there.
Mm-hmm. You're eager to ask a question. I can see that. Go ahead. Just a second.
I agree with most of what you're saying,
okay. But
I still have some reservations.
Sure.
Here's my concern. I think that the term evil can be overused, and I don't think it should be used in a very broad sense. I think your distinctions were valid. But the concept itself, I still feel that there are certain types of behaviors that couldn't be explained by anything else except something in the neighborhood of evil. I mean, it has intent. There are reasons for it. But example, talking about countries that indulge in ethnic cleansing, the Holocaust, Rwanda, what's going on in Darfur. There's no other reason. I mean, there are reasons, but I don't think anything justifies it.
That's great. That's a terrific thing to bring up. I think that's an outstanding thing to bring up. And the reason that I argue, as I do, about evil is we're not going to figure out why Hutus and Tutsis were annihilating one another if we view one side or the other or all of them as evil. Because that's the end of the discussion. If somebody's evil, well, that's why they did it. When you and I know that if we study human psychology sufficiently, we will ultimately learn why people were able to view people who formerly were living next door, that they were dating and going out with. You know that. Hutus and Tutsis married each other. They dated. They went to the same bars. What is it we need to learn in social psychology that allows people to change from one position to another? What is it that Philip Zimbardo in his famous prison experiment is really going on? I don't know how many of you know about this experiment. I'll explain it very briefly for those of you who haven't heard it. Philip Zimbardo was a Stanford professor who taught 30-some years ago at Stanford and got funding to perform an experiment in which he took students who were willing to volunteer and randomly selected some to be guards and some to be inmates and put them in a situation in which the guards were in charge of the inmates. They were not given instructions to beat or hurt anybody, but simply to herd them and control them. Within days, the guards were beating the inmates. And it got so bad, and this was supposed to go on for 30 days, it got so bad within a week that they shut the experiment down. There's something inside of people. We have a hostile nature lurking inside of us. Nice people, and we need to study this. And calling it evil is not where the answer is going to be. We have to come to a deeper understanding about how people function. What makes people engage in genocide? What creates a Hitler? That's a scientifically understandable thing. We're just not there yet.
Let me propose an idea. I'll come right back to the questions, but I wanted to bring up this concept during the discussion because I think that the concept of evil also is loaded and imprecise and motivationally problematic. But I think another concept makes it a lot clearer of what it is that we call evil and what it is that you want to keep the concept of evil for, and that is cruelty. If we look at cruelty and we say, what is behind cruelty? And what is behind cruelty is taking pleasure in the pain of other people. That's how I would define it. It's taking pleasure in the pain of other people. And that's what we're afraid of. We're afraid of other people taking pleasure from our pain, because then they want to hurt us. Now, you take people who are married for 40 years, you know, and there is some cruelty involved. And if you find somebody
who's... Did my wife talk to you this evening?
No, no. Happily married for, you know, 30 years and finds out, you know, or even 5 years, and she finds out that her husband has cheated on her, she might want to put a golf club through the back window of his Cadillac. You know, up until that point, she might have thought, how great this has been, you know, for me and for my children, so on and so forth. But there's a switch automatically. Why is the switch automatic? Because love isn't something, and hate is not something which is substantive in itself. It's an automatic emotional reaction to what's going on in life. And love is our emotional reaction to the expectation that happiness is going to come from something, so it looks beautiful to us. And hate is our emotional expectation that something is going to cause us pain and suffering, and that's why we don't like it. And cruelty is, I think, if you wanted to reform the human race, you know, I don't know what all this time is being spent for on lust, because first of all, it's not going away. But second of all, it's not all that harmful in its form where it's not tied to cruelty and other things. But if you said cruelty, if you just said, we need to transcend cruelty, we need to stop taking pleasure in other people's pain, about 80% of the problems that we have being civilized would go away. But why do we take that pleasure? Once you see how widespread it is, even in loving relationships, you have to say, why is it? And I think it's pretty fundamental. We want to be important. I think that's one of the fundamental drives. Every individual is an individual. We feel our existence has to be important in some way, and we measure ourselves against other people because that's the way society has trained us and so on. And if we are feeling really bad, the only way that we can make ourselves feel more important than other people is to make them feel even worse. And so we get pleasure out of them being in worse shape than we are, and so we have to inflict it. This is why husbands that have been very good providers for a long time lose their job, come home, and beat their wives and their children for the first time ever. It's because they feel so bad they have to make somebody else who's dependent on them feel even worse. That's a very, very simplistic, but I wanted to throw the big idea out about it. That it's much, much more detailed than that. And one of the things that I like to talk about in terms of desire and fulfilling desire is that your motive for fulfilling any desire is multiple layered, and it's those motives that are your real desires. That's what you're really after. But anyway, so I wanted to throw that idea about cruelty, and maybe that's a different focus. But
ooh, it's good. That's a good start.
I had that relate to some of the things that have been said. What came to mind when I saw this in the brochure was that Winter Soldier investigation that happened after the Vietnam War, where these guys themselves came back and said, I used to be Joe College, and I got drafted, and I went over there and did things that were beyond even my worst fantasy, mm-hmm. and stuff that I right now don't even want to bring back to mind. Mm-hmm. But the fact that... what to me that said was that in all of us there is that potential,
yes.
for malicious violence like that.
Yes.
And anyway, just a couple other points. The other thing is, I think partly what you said is that when we project evil out, that's when it becomes dangerous. When we see evil,
say again?
When we see evil out here, that's when it becomes dangerous. And I've gone to, just for the hell of it, gone to a few religious right churches where everybody looks so incredibly well scrubbed. I mean, they have this look about them that they have never even, you know, thrown a toothpaste thing away.
That's a sign of illness. You know that, right?
Well, right. But I mean, I personally think everybody has, you know, possibility of major negativity in them, but I think the person to me that's dangerous is the one who totally sees it out there. And
I think we all do that. I think that that's part of the mechanism. I mean, we have, you know, and I think ultimately when neurology is sufficiently sophisticated, we will see that the brain itself represents these opponents, that down at the midbrain there are these fight and flight components which are, and I think that this desire this I don't even think it's, I would describe it as a desire. There is a motivating force to want to hurt when we feel hurt. And I think I would say that it's related to a mirroring. I think we live in a world of mirrors. We see ourselves out there, and so our hurt must be reflected out there to validate our reality. And our outer brain, especially our forebrain, as we've developed, as we've evolved, we've built more and more structures which make us more reasonable. So this is in conflict with that. And so nobody who's thinking, when we're thinking up here, we're not aware of what's down there. When we're down in there, we have no idea that there's more, that there's a better way. So I think we're, again, it's like a hall of mirrors. We can't see what we're doing at one time or another. And I think science is the answer.
Well, that's a mechanical, physiological answer. And I think the next couple hundred years will be very interesting, because I have a feeling that there's going to be a personality answer as opposed to a biological answer. But let me say one thing about the political impact of this. It's when people are hurting in a large number that they want a leader who's very angry and wants to hurt other people to be their leader. I think history shows that very, very clearly. Mm-hmm. And so it's also right in line with this thing. People are feeling that they need to do something to hurt other people. Now, you know, this comes in play in a lot of areas. You know, people want to hurt the fans of another football team if that football team beats their football team. They're not even involved. Now, we're kind of, I mean, this is, you know, sort of amazing when you step back from it. But this is very, very fundamental feelings. And I just want you to feel that we're slightly more civilized. Even with that going on, because in 6th century Constantinople, this went so far that there were chariot races all the time, and there were four different teams, four different colors, white, blue, red, yellow, something like that. And over a century, two of the color teams were gone, and there were only two teams left that were fighting each other all the time at the chariot races, but they were identified with political parties. And after a team would win at one of the chariot races, there would be a riot in the city. Not a riot like after a basketball game in when Detroit wins or something like that, but a real riot. In one of them, 10,000 people were killed because of that. Because obviously this chariot race and the politics that were involved with it were all tied together in how people felt about what was going on.
So I'm not at this point persuaded, and I guess it's a comment and then a question that might be a comment. So first, the comment quickly is that it seems that you're standing against the idea of the concept of evil because of how it's used, but and you connect that to it's some alleged religious basis. But whether it's, you know, there are lots of concepts out there that have been horribly used, but that doesn't mean they're not useful concepts. And one value of the concept of evil is that it can, I mean, if you don't believe that there's evil, then you're far more susceptible to it when it rears its head. I think that it's thrown around by political actors a lot because of its power, but it's kind of like the person, you know, crying wolf. You know, there are wolves out there, and when they keep crying wolf, you get desensitized. But that doesn't mean that the wolves don't exist. The wolves don't exist. So I think that the Bush administration did a disservice to us in the way they use this term. But that doesn't mean the term doesn't matter. And I guess the closing question is that the way this conversation is going, it's identifying the evil in people's actions. So you know, on a one-on-one basis, mostly. The soldier in war or whatever. But I think the more telling evidence for the existence of evil are the structures we produce, the institutions we produce, that sustain evil acts but allow us to hide behind the institution and therefore not recognize their, you know, for example, we went to say, well, you know, what Hitler did. But, you know, the whole country was written, you know, the Constitution was written by slave owners, and that was an institutional structure that they felt very comfortable continuing while talking about liberty. And that, I think, is a definition of evil. And it's not necessarily about cruelty. It's about maintaining their superiority. And sometimes that events it comes out, you know, means cruelty, but sometimes it just means oppression. And I think those things are evil.
Can I respond to that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to repeat myself because I feel like I presented several ways in which I believe that this is true, but I will inevitably repeat myself in saying that I think that there is a fundamental difference between looking at something which is perhaps an extremely undesirable result, a horrendous result, and the term evil, which gives the bad result its, you know, it takes away any scientific, any evaluation. Give me a second. Where that comes from and how that can be viewed in context, and it gives it its own reasoning. That when something is evil, it's bad. It is that way simply because of the existence of the force of evil, that there is some overriding, blanketing, directive force which produces a malicious result in and of itself. And when we do that, we don't look any deeper to see why did somebody do that? How did they get other people to feel the same way? How did that turn into something which we then viewed as having a heinous result? It is absolutely non-scientific because it's its own answer. Once you've said something is evil, there's nothing behind that. There must be some force out there that just made the badness happen.
On 2 points on this exchange. And by the way, we're quite open to people talking to one of the other comments as opposed to the speaker. So if you want to ask something directly to one of the other commenters, that's also fine. But the two points on this. One, crying wolf. It's very interesting because animals that are damaging to human life, like wolves, we're not that far away from when they were, but we're already. We still admire the wolves for their freedom, and the wolf is now some kind of an image of freedom and nice pack work, you know, a nice society and stuff like that. If you read Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs, when he was in the Mexico War in Texas, he lost more men to wolf packs attacking his troops than he lost to the Mexican army. And that was only 150 years ago. So we have forgotten why everybody wanted to get rid of the wolves and the tigers and the bears. Oh, my. No, that's one thing. And the other thing is, if you talk about a force of evil or a force of a force behind it, you have got this religious idea behind it. But also, there are individuals who are very willing to stir the cruel impulses or the hatred of other people in order to make something happen in their favor, regardless of the consequences. Even if they're not cruel themselves, it's just for their own pursuit of power or something. And those people are often called evil. So there's a reason why this word is so popular, but it might be able to be focused a little bit better.
I think the emphasis has to be on protecting you from these people. I read a wonderful book. It's called The Sociopath Next Door. I wish it had been written earlier, because I think if we took a show of hands, everyone here has in some way or another been scammed or taken by one of these type of people, salespeople, etc. And
lawyers.
It's true, used car people, politicians, what have you. And there are certain characteristics. Apparently, these are called sociopaths because they're not, they used to be psychopaths, but they're not psychotic. But there are characteristics, and I've enumerated them. They don't have any sense of guilt. They take joy in other people's misery, schadenfreude. They are pathological liars. They have something called pseudolalia fantastica, which is this boasting and bragging and how great they are. They are focused and absorbed by the need for both power and money. They're extremely manipulative. But they also have this charm and ingratiating. And if any one of you seen the CNBC series on American Greed, you'll understand what I'm talking about. So I think and 4% of the people supposedly have this, they're males predominantly, and maybe only 0.5% of the population are females, the black widows, etc. So I think what one has to do, and if I had read this book earlier, I might have been protected from this type of character disorder as opposed to the mood disorder.
Yeah. I'm surprised the percentages are so small, actually. A lot of that behavior is what drives economic success. And actually what's interesting about that is a lot of that economic success has greater humanitarian effects on large numbers of people's lives in terms of their physical well-being and everything, even though the intent was sociopathic, which I find ironic.
I wonder what percentage of politicians meet that.
One last thing. I always feel that the politicians, not all of them, but a large number of them, are a little bit like movie stars and politicians. They remind me of two-year-olds. When you were 2 years old, you walked into the room and everyone said, "Hey, it's great you're here. It's great you're here." And, you know, a lot of people spend their life trying to recreate that moment. Because it goes away pretty quickly after you pass 3 or 4. And I think those who are still trying to recreate that moment, find their own niche in society in this way.
As I hear you speak, I'm reminded of the West Side Story song, Officer Krumpke. I don't know how many of you remember that. But Hitler has been mentioned several times, and you mentioned Hitler, perhaps the quintessential example of what most of us would consider to be evil, whether or not used in the context you said. And I really don't feel that you have to be a believer to believe in the existence of something that is evil or acts that are evil. And the problem I'm having with your rationalization of this is that you say, well, you have to look behind it. You have to look at it in context. Even if you do, even if you look at Hitler in context, he was probably ill-treated by his parents or had very little parental contact. He was suffering from the trauma that Germany went through after World War I and how horribly those people were treated. Nevertheless, even if there's background, everyone doesn't react the same way. And Hitler selected out a group of people, Jews, homosexuals, and a few other groups, for special, horrible, evil treatment. Mm-hmm. And to rationalize that, and I think that's what it is, by saying, well, there's a reason behind this. If we look deep enough, we'll find it, and it isn't really evil. I don't buy it. Too many people have been raised under similar circumstances as people who have done evil things and have not come out that way. And to me, they are good. They've overcome their circumstances.
Okay, so let me give you my reading of. I hear you as a group, but let me give you my reading of what you just said. What you have just said is that at some level, that there is something that is cannot be scientifically probed and explained about the badness, the heinousness, the horribleness of what occurred. And I disagree. I think that we must not do that. We owe it to society to not look at it that way. And I'm not saying in any way, hey, I'm a Jew. I have relatives who died in the Holocaust. I'm not a Hutu or a Tutsi, but I think that that's horrible. I'm not a Native American, but I think the annihilation of those people in this country, these are all horrible things. And we can go back historically and cite example after example. But I don't think that at some point calling it, using a non-scientific, globalizing term that expresses our passion about the horribleness of it will give us the answers. We must set that aside at some point and say, this is, in fact, we must use the imperative nature of the salute, of finding a solution, to set everything aside except the facts and study them very carefully. Look at not only, because remember, Hitler didn't work alone.
If it was just Hitler, that wouldn't have happened. We're talking about an entire society that did that. And if you think that German people are responsible for that, I think you're going to miss the next thing that's going to start someplace else, because it's not about German people. It's about what we don't yet fully understand about the functioning of the human brain, and whether we talk about it as neurology or personality, I think we must look at all of these different things so that we can end what we cannot tolerate. We must end human aggression. We have to put an end to it, and we won't do it. We stop ourselves from doing it as soon as we put this globalizing blanket of evil over it. And I understand the desire to do it because it's so bad, but it's not the way.
Yeah. I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that you're listening to Matt Cantor's talk on Does Evil Exist at the Commonwealth Club of California. And there's a good example of the passion that I was talking about. One of the things that's really crucial, I think, here in the discussion is, I think, for all of us to understand that we want to do something to protect ourselves from people who come after the human race, are out to destroy what civilization we've been able to put together. And I'll make a comment on that, because at least for people who are thinking about these ideas, the civilization that we've been able to create, whatever that is a very desirable object, because it keeps us apart from total chaos. And therefore, it's a very precious thing to us. And I'll explain how precious that is in a very simple sentence. We, as a society, not everybody, but a very small portion of the society, all around the world, we keep and restore and pay a lot of money to keep examples of great art, great architecture, whatever will give us the belief that humanity is capable of great, beautiful, noble things. If there were millions of people creating that kind of noble, beautiful stuff all the time, we would not be keeping the old stuff. We would just keep making more and more of it. It's because it is so rare that we hold it so preciously and spend lots of money to keep it. Even if it was something like the Colosseum, which looks really neat, but, you know, was used not for all that great purpose. But we keep it anyway, because we want to think of humanity as great and achieving this. Now, my interest in the whole subject from this point of view, what you're saying is, can we get to the point where we are going to say, yes, we should work on this subject, but let's focus in on what can be done and what can't be done, and what is humanity the way it really is? Because I think a big part of the problem is that we've set such high standards for humanity. The people at this end of the bell curve who've given us all of our standards are talking about their next project. They're leaping out in this direction. That's where they're headed. You know, everybody else is still here. They're not even on the boat. And how do we deal with the way people really are, with the fact that they do have, when they're hurt, the desire to hurt other people? How do you manage that in the way that produces the best result? And is that a good? If it is coercive, it's another totally different question, because is the coerciveness needed to accomplish what you're after a cure that's worse than the disease? It's also very important to keep in mind, because when we are passionate, as you've said, when you're passionate even about evil, when you're passionate about good, you often lose sight of what the reality is, and maybe a certain amount of understanding precedes it. It's like, you know, humanity, there are certain people who are trying to cure certain, actually fairly small problems that humanity does, and they spend all their effort on that, which is a very good thing, but you know, we're so far away from being in that position. For example, you know, if somebody took on, trying to protect cockroaches from cruel behavior by humanity, you know, something like that, and said, well, there are all these billions of cockroaches, and they don't understand us. Yes, that's true, and they like to eat our garbage. That's true. It's kind of a nice thing, but, you know, they come into our kitchen. We don't like that. If somebody was an advocate for cockroaches, you know, it would be a very hard sell. But I would just say, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world to try to give an understanding of how cockroaches look at the world and how they do. But at the same time, I think we need to do a few things first before we get to that point.
Well, aren't you just stating that we're hopefully in an age of increased tolerance, and that's the greatest advance that perhaps our society has made. I think in terms of tolerance.
I think, you know, I would love to believe that it was just tolerance. I think it has a lot to do with prosperity and people not being so hurt feeling all the time. That might be more crucial, and ironically, because for thousands of years, people who have taken humanity, you know, difficulties at heart and have tried to propose a solution, none of them said, make everybody richer by making technological improvements and then everybody can be, you know, have better housing and better food and better medical care. But the last century has said, look, not only are there billions more people, but, you know, the people behave better towards each other under those circumstances. When we look at the facts, I think it's a myth that poverty will lead. But now, I'm going to officially end this program because we're at the end. And anybody who wants to continue the discussion is more than welcome to stay. But I would like to say thank you once again to Matt Cantor for the presentation on a topic that we'll be discussing for thousands of years.
And thank you. And thank all of you.
And I'd like to thank our audience here at the club as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned, and those who want to stay and keep discussing are welcome.